Hello, everyone. This is Trevor Justice with the Vegetarian Health Institute. Tonight's topic is savory soups, and our guest expert is Lenore Baum, who is the author of Sublime Soups and Lenore's Natural Cuisine. How are you doing, Lenore?
I'm great. How are you, Trevor?
Pretty good. Pretty good. In fact, I'm starting to get hungry reading these soup recipes again.
Good.
So I'm wondering if you want to kind of summarize the key points from the written lesson for people that haven't read it yet before we go into the new student questions.
Okay. I'll just kind of skim over it to allow time for questions, and if there aren't questions enough, I will go back and do more detail. So soups are my passion because it's really my favorite food. It's warming and nourishing and wholesome, and in these economic times, very inexpensive. And we eat it for breakfast here in Asheville, North Carolina, and I ate it for breakfast in Phoenix, Arizona, and Michigan. It's just anywhere you live, you can eat it for breakfast and have a small bowl for lunch or a big bowl or have it for dinner. And it's a great travel food. You can easily put it in a thermos. And it's extremely forgiving. Basically, any ingredient in a soup recipe that you don't like, you'd leave out, and it should come out as long as there's some kind of a little bit of fat in, a little bit of salt, and then the basic ingredient like beans. And if it's too thin, you can thicken it. If it's too thick, you can thin it. It makes great leftovers. And so that's basically why my passion is soups.
Got it.
And some of the soup basics are, you know, when recipes call for vegetables to be cut up when it's going to be a blended soup, it kind of makes me crazy. You know, it says mince vegetables. You don't have to mince vegetables, you know, just coarsely chop them. It's going in the blender anyway, and it makes a really fast preparation that way. Let's see. One thing that would add complexity and depth to food is sautéing. It's not necessary, and if you're running out of time, you can just eliminate that step. But sautéing, like onions and garlic, before it's put into the soup really adds a delicious depth to it.
I have a question about that one, Lenore.
Yeah.
You know, in our program, we try to encourage people to get their fats from whole foods like avocados, nuts, and seeds,
right?
And to minimize oil. So, how important is it from a taste standpoint, or I shouldn't say important, but how dramatic is the difference in taste when you sauté the vegetables first versus not?
Well, first of all, I only use about a half a teaspoon of
very little
coconut oil. Yeah, so it's such a little amount. And it caramelizes, for instance, onions. So it really gives it, it's sort of that umami flavor.
Mm-hmm.
It really gives it that extra depth. It's not critical, but I just made some soup today, gingered squash soup, and I didn't saute it. I just decided not to do it and see the difference, and there really was a noticeable difference. I mean, you know, soup is soup. I love soup anyway. It's made, but if you want something that's got more flavor, then you sauté.
So a half a teaspoon, so little. Do you use like an extra small skillet, or how do you make spread?
Well, I use these pans that are diamond. They're nonstick, but they're embedded with little diamond particles.
Okay.
So it takes very little oil. It's just enough to allow it to make more heat between the vegetable, like the onions, and the pan.
Interesting. So the typical nonstick pans I don't use because I'm always afraid, you know, some of the little nonstick stuff will come off in the food. What is this type of pot that you're describing?
Well, there's a couple. There's scan pan and Swiss diamond, and they are nonstick, but they're embedded with very hard material. One of them has diamond particles, and the other one has ceramic titanium particles, so it hardens. It's a slurry that is mixed in with the nonstick, so that it's very, very hard. I had a metallics person, somebody with a degree in a PhD in metallurgy, evaluate them for me, and he felt that they were okay. And I don't use any utensils that would scratch it or anything like that, you know.
Sure.
I use wooden. So, you know, and they're very easy to clean up. And I know it's not the ideal. Ideally, it would be cast iron, but they're awfully heavy and hard to take care of.
And if someone
enamel,
did want...
and they're very heavy. Pardon?
If someone was using cast iron to saute, could they get away with half a teaspoon of oil as
No, they'd probably have to use two or three times that. But still, it's not that much. And coconut oil is a good quality oil. So, it's got a high flash point, so it doesn't degenerate. It doesn't deteriorate the way,
right,
like olive oil. For years, I used olive oil thinking that was the right oil, but of course it isn't for heating up because it will... You know, it just breaks apart. It's got a low flash point.
Are you using flash point to mean the same thing as the smoking point?
Yeah, the smoking point. Yeah, I call it flash point. Yes, smoking point.
Okay.
Exactly.
All right. Yeah, so I just want to point everyone listening to lesson number, just a sec here, lesson number 23, where Vasanto Molina talks about the best oils for raw versus cooked, and there's a smoke point table in there. So if anyone's curious, I'll tell you right now what it says. Let's see here. Olive oil has, is this right? This is pretty high. It says that extra virgin, the smoke point is 375 degrees, and the one that's not extra virgin, the smoke point is 420 degrees. That sounds pretty high.
Coconut oil?
Yeah, I'm sure it's higher. Oh, interesting. I thought it'd be higher. It says here that refined coconut oil can be heated up to 450,
mm-hmm,
as opposed to 420 or 375 for olive. So it's a little higher, not as big of a gap as I thought.
Yeah, it's not as big as I remembered either. Well, I like coconut oil, and I often use, Expeller pressed coconut oil doesn't have any coconut flavor to it. So if I'm not cooking with something that I want, if I don't want a coconut flavor, I'll use expeller pressed. If I want coconut flavor, then I will use regular coconut oil, virgin.
Got it.
Yeah. So I'll go back to talking some more about soup basics.
Okay.
Because one of my favorite things is pressure cooking. And I know a lot of people have fear of pressure cooking because they've heard stories from their mothers and grandmothers about pea soup on the ceiling and things like that. But the new generation pressure cooker isn't like that. There are three safety features on it, and it's very unlikely unless you walk away and have it turned on high, you know, for 20 minutes, and then it might spatter onto the side but not up to the ceiling. But pressure cooking, I mean, in like 12 minutes, you can cook a bean soup, which would normally take an hour to simmer on the stove. So not only does it save time, but it really saves the resources on the planet because you're not using fuel for that long. And it marries the flavors. It just, you know, it's there under 15 pounds per square inch, and all that pressure is mingling, commingling the flavors. And it's just a wonderful way to especially make bean soups.
Yep. Actually, I think you know we had a whole lesson on pressure cooking, lesson 43, and Jill Nussanel was our guest expert.
Yes, yes. Well, I concur.
Do you also have videos or anything specifically on pressure cooking?
We're actually in the process of putting some videos together.
Mm-hmm.
I don't at this point, but my husband has been filming a lot of my classes, and he's going to edit them, and we're going to put them on the website and make them available.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay, well, keep going.
Okay, let's see. Any soup would be actually much more delicious and create a rich, velvety texture without adding fat if you blended like 3 or 4 cups of it. So you take 3 or 4 cups of the soup after it's cooked, put it in the blender, and then pour it back into the soup pot, and then it becomes like a rich base.
Mm-hmm.
This is particularly true of bean soup or even vegetable soups. And
now, I read about you're using an immersion blender, which is
yes,
sort of like a handheld. Is that how you normally do it?
Well, that no, if I'm blending the entire soup, like a vegetable soup, I will use the hand or the immersion blender and put it right in the pot, and I won't have to mess up dirty a blender. But if I'm just taking a portion of it out, then I would put it in a blender and then pour it back into the pot.
Got it.
And the hand immersion blenders are really great, but I don't feel that they don't make a smooth texture when you're trying to work with beans, because beans have that skin, and I feel a regular blender or high-speed blender works better for those. A lot of the soups in my cookbook are pressure cooked and blended, because it means you just put big chunks of things, of the vegetables and everything, in the pot, pressure cook it or cook it on the stove or even in a crock pot all day. And then put it in the blender, and it becomes this wonderful, creamy, satisfying, nutritious, high-fiber meal.
So I have a question.
Center of the meal.
I've made soups where it was kind of like a very watery stock with beans and vegetables floating in it. And I could see how doing this and blending a portion of the soup would make it a lot more thick. Also wondering if it makes it more flavorful, because the beans or vegetables, because the stock itself would have all the pureed
yes.
beans and vegetables
yeah.
in it.
Yeah, that's another good point. Yeah, absolutely. And the other way to thicken a soup, of course, is to add some cooked rice or rolled oats. And I think I put a recipe in there for cream of broccoli or cream of green bean soup. And you can use rolled oats or cooked brown rice and then blend that with that, and that becomes a... you know, like a creamier base without having to add milk, whether it be almond milk or soy milk or cow's milk.
Right.
It becomes a non-dairy version, yeah.
Right,
and you can also use starchy vegetables, you know, like yams or carrots or squash, and that will thicken it, especially if you take 3 or 4 cups and blend it and put it back in.
It's interesting that root vegetables, which are relatively low in fat, can end up giving it such a creamy texture.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. Well, I guess they're fibrous, for one thing. I don't know, but it's true, it does.
It's good. It's a way to make it creamy without necessarily adding more fat.
Absolutely. A lot of my recipes are that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
and
is there
also
anything else?
Well, these creamy soups can also be used as a sauce. I used to pour them over grain or noodles for a quick meal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's just a different way of using it, aside as, you know, besides just having it as a soup, a bowl of soup.
Okay.
Presentation, I'll just say a couple quick more things. Presentation, I think, is important. And if the cook has a couple extra minutes and is willing to cut up a little bit of parsley or scallion to put on top of the soup, it makes a nice contrast. The color green, and it's raw with the cooked soup. And you know, we eat with our eyes, of course, so besides our mouths. And it'd be nice to have that contrast.
Right.
And with
our noses.
Pardon?
With
our noses, yes, of course.
I mean,
if I smell
fresh chopped cilantro on something, it definitely makes it more appetizing.
Absolutely. That's another good garnish, yeah. Most soups can be stored for about a week, and they can be frozen for months. I freeze them in glass jars, those mason jars. You just have to leave about a 2-inch headspace, it's called, or, you know, empty space where there's no soup, so that it allows room to expand. Once in a while, a jar will break, but usually they don't.
But you should, so you leave a couple of inches of space so
right.
the soup can expand.
Empty, yeah, so it can expand.
Okay.
And I don't really think that stock is necessary, but I'm not a really gourmet cook. I'm a practical. I like to make tasty, quick things that are nourishing, high density, high nutrient density. And so I just don't take the time to make stocks. But I can use Herbamare. Once in a while, I will use Herbamare. I'm not using as much now because there's more salt in it than I want to use. But
could you spell that for people?
H-E-R-B, A-M-E-R-E.
Okay.
And it's basically it's infused salt. In other words, they take a bunch of vegetables like celery, leek, watercress, onion, parsley, and garlic and thyme, and they dehydrate them and put them in with sea salt and leave it, like, I think it's 3 weeks or something, and it infuses the salt and everything. The flavors mingle, and then they put it in package, and it's by A. Vogel, V-O-G-E-L. I think it's German. But it has a nice flavor. I mean, just I would use less. I used to use like a half a teaspoon a quart, but now I would probably use a quarter teaspoon just because there's more salt in it than I want.
Got it.
But mostly I use miso, you know, the aged fermented soybean. That has a nice complexity, and there is salt in it, but there's a lot of flavor, too, a lot of punch.
And is the salt in miso always sea salt or no?
Oh, yeah, pretty much. I mean, any good quality miso, yeah.
Which brands do you like?
This one is not probably well known. Tadashina and Josen, these are mostly Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
I get them from Natural Import.
What about South River?
Oh, yes, of course, South River. I like their sweet white miso and their chickpea miso.
Mm-hmm.
The barley miso.
Yeah, they actually
they
contributed some, let's see, miso recipes in lesson 30.3. And seven ways to sneak miso into your daily meals is lesson 30.1, which also came from them.
Yeah, they're really good people. I saw their operation. You know, they built their own place with pegs and everything. It's this beautiful wooden building that they've been making it for years. I must have seen it probably 25 years ago.
Look, we've got 10 questions from the students, so why don't we move over to
those. See what people want to know.
Oh, except not all these questions are relevant to soup, so I'm going to skip over the ones. So, students on the line, if you've asked a question and we're not answering it, it's because it's not relevant to this topic. But please post more questions that are relevant to soups. So
well,
the first
if there's
one,
time at the end, I'm willing to answer if I can, even if they're not relevant. But that's
all
up
right
to you.
Well, the first one is from Nancy. Can any soup recipe be converted to a crockpot one and vice versa?
That is a good question, and I knew it was going to come up. I have not worked with the crock pot for probably 25 or 30 years, but my best guess is that you can. If you're working with beans, you absolutely have to soak. I soak the beans anyway. You want to remove the phytic acid, the enzyme from it.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely soak the beans overnight before you put it in the crock pot. Rinse off the beans and then put them in the crock pot and start with very hot or boiling water.
Hmm.
It should work all day long. She'll have to try it and then let me know. She can go to my website and tell me. But I would think so. That's my best guess. I like to cook on gas, so I just stopped using an electric pot, you know, electricity from the crock pot many years ago. But it's so handy. I mean, why not?
Right. Okay.
Okay.
Next one is from Christina. And she says, is it true that vegetables lose their potency when cooked? And does potentially overcooking veggies outweigh the nutritional benefit of soup?
Interesting question. I think any way you can get vegetables is a plus, as my mother would say. It's a plus. And I don't think you certainly don't lose fiber. You don't lose any fat-soluble vitamins. You know, you'll lose vitamin C in cooking because of heat.
Right.
But other than that, I mean, obviously enzymes are lost in that process. But we eat greens 3 times a day, and they're not raw most of the time. And I just eat so many more greens when they're cooked, but I think it's better to cook them, even though I know there's a loss of enzymes. But
right.
Other than that, I you'd have to ask someone like Dr. Clapper.
Okay, well, here, I'll ask you three specific, more specific questions related to that.
Okay.
Well, the first one's really just a comment, not a question. And it's true, with certain vegetables, spinach, for example, you can get a lot, you can eat a lot more of it when it's cooked.
Right.
I was just working on an article today. Let me see if I have this number in front of me. In order to get the same amount of protein from spinach that you'll get from one veggie burger, you'd have to eat either 12 cups of raw spinach or 2.3 cups of cooked spinach.
Mm.
Now, I could imagine, although it's kind of a lot, I could imagine eating 2.3 cups of cooked spinach. That's not unthinkable. But 12 cups of raw spinach, it would, would take a while to eat. So,
yeah.
So just that's one example. Now, not every vegetable cooks down as much as spinach.
Well, also, there's so much, for example, oxalic acid in raw spinach that cooking it will at least eliminate some of it. So on the other hand, you could probably eat more cooked vegetables like spinach, and it wouldn't affect you. If you know, oxalic acid is something that bothers me. It tends to kick up arthritis. So I can eat it. I can eat it cooked much better than raw.
Right. Well, that's true. Spinach is one of those vegetables high in oxalic acid, which we talk about in lesson three on calcium. But I'm also just making the point that for any vegetable that cooks down and becomes smaller once it's cooked, you can eat a greater volume of it. And for those nutrients that aren't harmed in cooking, you know, you're getting more of those nutrients.
Benefiting, right.
Now, the other thing is, as an argument in favor of soups, Dr. Clapper, you know, taught us all about acrylamides in lesson 16, I believe. And so acrylamides form when foods, especially starchy foods, are heated above 248 degrees. But as he points out, the boiling point of water, I guess in a regular pot, is only 212. So you'd never have to worry about acrylamides with anything. He encourages soups and stews because of the fact that you never have to worry about acrylamides, unlike with baking.
Right.
However, I asked Jill this question on the pressure cooking call, and I'm going to ask you because she didn't think she had the definitive answer. If someone makes soups in a pressure cooker, is the temperature higher than 248? And if it is, do you have any clue if starchy foods might be subject to acrylamides?
I don't have a definitive answer either, but I don't think acrylamides are an issue in a pressure cooker.
Okay. Jill also said that that because of the fact that there's so much moisture around the starchy vegetables, and it's not like a dry heat as in an oven, that she didn't think it was an issue.
Yeah, and I don't think it gets much hotter than that. I mean, 212 is boiling, right?
Right.
Yeah.
It does get hotter than that, though.
Yeah, but I don't think it gets anywhere near 275 or 300. But
okay.
It's probably the answer is probably on the internet somewhere.
Okay, that's okay. We'll find out.
yeah.
Now, what else did I want to say? So there's one reason that a lot of people, especially those who are inclined towards more raw foods, one reason that we prefer steaming over boiling is there's a sense that less of the nutrition is lost into the boiling water. And obviously with soups, the vegetables are in the water. So if certain nutrients are released into the water, but then you're drinking the water, is that a net effect of no loss?
Right, absolutely no loss. And, you know, down south here, when so many people would drink the pot liquor, they would call it, they would cook greens, collard greens, and they would drink the liquid that it was cooked in. I think it's awfully bitter myself, but they really maintained their health that way, the people who did that. Up until the 40s, that was pretty common.
Right,
in
okay.
In the poor South.
Of course, as you said earlier, vitamin C and other anything else that's heat sensitive is going to be lost.
But as far as I can think anyway, vitamin C is the only thing that's going to be lost besides enzymes.
Okay.
In heating.
All right. Next question, also from Christina. Is it true that crockpots have BPA in the liner, and should we not use that?
Oh, I don't think so. BPA is usually usually in a plastic, and if there's a lining, I know that they were lining tin cans with it briefly, but it's usually ceramic. I mean, all the crockpots I ever knew about in the old days, and my mother had one until about 5 years ago, and it looked like straight ceramic to me, glazed. I don't think so. I mean, she could check the company. She could call, but I really doubt that.
Okay. And you know, Christina, if you go to the website for the manufacturer of any particular crockpot,
right,
you can probably just find their email address or a contact form on there, and it could be as easy as emailing them the question.
Mm-hmm.
All right, next question is from Charmaine. She wants to know, and this obviously half of this question would only apply to ovo-lacto-vegetarians, but she asks, do you use any mustard seeds or ghee to add a smoky flavor to your soups?
Smoky flavor. I don't think I'd use ghee or mustard seed for smoky, but maybe you could. I do use mustard seed, and occasionally I use ghee. I use an olive oil coconut ghee. There's a little bit of butter in it, too, I think. For smoky flavor, I would use smoked salt.
Okay.
And there's also something called liquid smoke. It's kind of funky. I don't know. It's sitting in my pantry, but I haven't used it in years. I don't know. When I did use it, it did give a smoky flavor. But it's chemicals. Even the natural stuff has got chemicals. But I would use smoked salt.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There's also, if anyone's interested in the smoky flavor, Lesson 6, Meaty Recipes, was authored by Eric Tucker, the chef at Millennium Restaurant in San Francisco, which is a well-known kind of gourmet vegan restaurant. And he talks in Lesson 6 about how to give a meaty flavor or texture to foods. And some of the – here, I think I'm looking at it right now, what he recommends for smoky flavors. Just a sec here.
Something exotic, I remember.
Here it is. You don't need a smoker. It's pretty easy to find smoked salt, smoked paprika, smoked dulse, or smoked tea leaves, and good quality liquid smoke. And he points out that all of these might be safer than actually smoking foods because the ash and tar are filtered out.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's go to the next one. This is from Michelle. I'm not familiar with this type of oil spelled C-A-R-O, Caro oil, but she wants to know what you think of it.
I've never heard of it.
Okay.
I don't know.
Michelle, did you mean canola? Were you trying to abbreviate canola? Let us know, because we're not familiar with Caro oil.
why don't you answer
the question for canola, in case that's what she meant?
Well, canola was the big fad about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, and it's lost favor. It's rapeseed oil, R-A-P-E, rapeseed, and they grow it in fields where there's a lot of spraying, supposedly. I don't know. I don't remember all the details. I gave it up about 10 years ago. There's a lot of information on the Internet about it, but I don't use it, and it's not really recommended so much.
Okay.
Really, the oils in favor, I feel, are sesame and olives and coconut and flax. I don't really even like flax oil. I'd rather use freshly ground flax if I'm going to use it in a salad dressing. And then it becomes a thickener and it's fresh. But anyway.
Yeah, good. I feel like I want to refer students to a couple of the other lessons on this topic. So there's the one on best oils, raw versus cooked. That's Lesson 23 by Vasanto Molina. And I remember her saying that she felt when you're using oils for salad dressings or if anything that's cold, use flax oil, obviously, because mm-hmm. of the really excellent ratio of omega-3s to 6s. Mm-hmm. And when you're cooking, she recommended either olive or coconut, depending on how high the temperature is going to be. There's something else I wanted to say about the omega-3s, I think. Oh, canola oil has a surprisingly good ratio of omega-3s to 6s. And for anyone that wants to review that, in Lesson 5 on omega-3s, we talk about the importance of not having too much omega-6 in your diet. And most oils have way more omega-6 than omega-3. So flax and hemp and canola are the winners if you're just looking at it in terms of which ones have the best ratios and the most omega-3.
Yes, but I also think it's good to look at the quality, and I just don't think the canola oil is good quality oil. We put hemp and flax in a lot of foods, in a lot of dishes. I use it a lot during the day, so, you know, I think the ratio can be balanced with better quality food.
Sure.
Like hemp and, yeah.
Are you saying you grind the seeds rather than
using
the
oil? Yeah, I grind
the
seeds and I make flax crackers. You know, I dehydrate flax crackers and eat those.
Okay.
And things like that. So, and hemp
I put
in smoothies and puddings and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Do you use chia seeds? They seem to be catching on
I
as
do.
Another.
Oh, yeah. I use quite a bit of chia. Yeah.
Okay, good. I'm similar to you. I actually don't buy flax oil. I grind a tablespoon of flax seeds every day, and I just put it in water with other supplements, although you certainly could just sprinkle it on top of other meal that you're eating.
Yeah, or you could put in salad dressing, too. It's not as strong as I thought it was before I started using it, but it thickens salad dressing, and it's great omega-3s, and
it's
fresh. Keep it refrigerated.
Okay, good. Next question, also from CK. Are the misos you have on your website gluten-free? Now, is she referring to your website? Do you have misos listed there?
No, I don't. Okay. I don't sell any. I refer people to Natural Import. Maybe she's looking at that.
She's probably looking at our website then. She's probably asking about the South River miso.
Well, I mean, There is not wheat in miso. It's typically soybean and a grain. So it would be soybean and barley would be barley miso. Chickpea miso would be chickpeas. I'm not sure what the grain is, if there is any grain in that one. Where there is wheat, is maybe she's thinking of shoyu or soy sauce. Soy sauce has wheat in it unless you buy tamari. And tamari is wheat-free.
Okay.
That's, you know...
So most miso has soybeans in it plus a grain like barley or brown rice.
Yes, but not wheat. I mean, it's possible, but I've never heard. I've been cooking this way for 35 years. I've never heard of wheat being in miso, but it's possible. They put leeks in miso. You know, you can get soybeans with leeks. South River makes it.
Okay.
So there's lots of different things, but I just don't think wheat.
Just check the ingredient label.
Yeah.
All right. Next question is from Michelle. What about using rice cookers with a steam feature to make soups?
Well, a rice cooker I have never used, so I don't know. I suppose you could. I don't know what the advantage is. I mean, I don't know. I guess it's timed or something. To me, I just like old-fashioned pressure cookers or just stovetop or crock pot if you want. But it's possible. I just don't know how they work, so I can't really answer that.
Well, actually, that leads us to her next question. I don't think I've asked you this yet. She wants to know what brand of pressure cooker you prefer.
I forget the exact model because there's all different models, but I think it's a Spanish one, Fagor, F-A-G-O-R.
Yeah, that sounds like the one Jill recommended.
Oh, did she? Yeah, yeah.
They make a model where you can, you can either have a larger size or a smaller size. It has like two containers.
That's
the brand
that
she recommended.
That's right. Yeah, you can get a four quart pressure cooker, a six. I think a six quart is pretty much the optimal size for almost any family of four or for two people or whatever. I mean, I used to have three pressure cookers or four or five, who knows how many, but now I pretty much stick to the 6-quart and the 8-quart.
Okay.
If I'm making a double batch, then I, because you're never supposed to fill a pressure cooker more than half full.
Right.
When you're cooking with beans, because the skins could get caught in there, up in the top and in the nozzle or whatever that is.
Okay. And so Cindy has a question. Have you ever used nutritional yeast for a cheesy flavor?
I haven't very much in the past. A long time ago, in the early 70s, I did. And it certainly works for that, and you can. I think if you're going to use nutritional yeast, then try to go for Red Star. It supposedly has the most B12 in it, and it's considered high quality.
Yep.
I've never tried it in a soup. I've used it in salads and things, you know, like
right.
I don't remember what kinds of salads. This is so long ago, but, yeah, sure. What's her name, Joe
Stepaniak.
She did a whole cookbook on it. And she uses nutritional yeast in everything. So that would be a great place to look if she wants to use it and get the cheesy flavor.
Right. Also, Joe contributed a few recipes to our program. You can find Lesson 15.21 is her cashew cheese sauce. And let's see what else. If there's another one that has B12 in it. Just a sec here. Is this it? There's a zucchini cheddar soup, lesson 13.6. And then there's if you go to our vitamin B12 lesson, which is lesson 9, I think, let me just take a look. Lesson 9.6 is called Integrating Red Star Nutritional Yeast into Your Meals. And there is a recipe in there that Joe provided, which is a nutritional yeast gravy. So there you go. Okay, next question is from Anne Marie. And she says, hi, Lenore. I'm sort of a lazy cook and sometimes get intimidated by soup recipes that call for a broth that has to be all ready. Is there a quick way to make a good broth that doesn't take much time?
Well, that's what I talked about a little earlier, using Herbamare or Vogue. I think it's Vogue makes a really nice concentrated instant broth. I'm almost positive it's I can look in my pantry here, Vogue. But if you're doing something flavorful like miso, that really gives you that broth. A lot of complexity and flavor in the broth without having to make a broth. Vogue, yeah, it's called Vogue, V-O-G-U-E, Instant Veggie Base. And it's been sitting there for a long time because I just don't ever use it anymore. I used it a couple times. But I don't think it's necessary. With lots of flavorful vegetables and beans, I don't know. And then I use spices and herbs. It just has lots of flavor.
There was something you referred to in the lesson. I think it started with an H. And
Herbamare.
Herbamare. Okay, so how is that spelled?
H-E-R-B-A-M-E-R-E. The only thing I was cautioning about that was that there is salt in it, and you just need to cut back on the salt.
Is it high mineral sea salt or just regular salt?
I don't know. I don't know. It doesn't taste like high mineral sea salt to me, but I think they do call it sea salt, but it's just not the quality of like Himalayan or Celtic sea salt. Let me look. I can find it here under the H's. I've got alphabetical spices here. Let's see. Where are you? G-H. Well, now I'm not seeing it.
Yeah. It's okay.
Okay, well, you know, it's probably on the next shelf. Here it is. Here's a big jar. Okay. I will tell you what it says here. Sea salt. But sea salt is the first ingredient, so which means it's got the most of that. Whatever the first, you know, obviously the first ingredients in a list are the ones that are the highest in volume. So there's more sea salt in it than celery or leek or chives, yeah. So where the veggie base does not have salt, and it does have brewer's yeast, though.
Okay, how is that different than nutritional yeast? Is that more like the yeast you use to make bread rise?
No, I think it's the kind of yeast that's used in, I don't know if it's interchangeable. I'm just not a big yeast person, so I'm really not an expert on this. I think sometimes they say nutritional yeast and brewer's yeast are interchangeable in the naming of it, but I don't think that's right, so I don't know. Somebody will have to look it up. I'm sorry, I just don't.
Okay.
That's not my thing.
All right, I'll just say if anyone's on the call and has a question about that topic, post it to our comment section. And by the way, we reopened a week ago the comments area under each lesson post, so it's easier to post comments or questions now than it was when we only had forums.
Great.
Okay, next one is from Suzanne. You mentioned using kudzu for thickening. What's your source? Health food store, or do you order online?
Natural Import.
Is that online?
Well, that's online, yeah. It's online.
Natural.
And it's on the east part. It's here, actually, in Asheville, North Carolina. But you can get it online. And really, any natural food store like Whole Foods or Natural Foods Co-op should have it.
Okay.
It's really good for the intestines and stomach, too. It's really medicinal. It's not just a thickening agent. It's lovely.
Mm.
I use it in puddings and thickening, all kinds of things.
Mm. Great. And we have more information about that in our lesson on sea vegetables. That's, let's see real quick, sea vegetables, lesson 35. Okay, next question is from Cindy. Have you used chia seeds to thicken soups?
I have not.
Okay.
I have not.
All right.
But that's a thought. Could certainly try it.
I assume, like, if it were flax seeds, you'd grind them first. Would you also recommend that for chia?
Yeah, there's a really expensive chia they're promoting now, especially at Living Light, that's like $60 a pound, which is broken apart. I don't know. I suppose it's ground. It's supposedly much higher in omega-3s, like 12 times higher than regular chia. I don't know. But anyway, it is broken apart. So I would imagine that's what I would do, is I would put it in a spice blender and crush it up first and then put it in.
Right, okay.
Yeah,
so
I wouldn't certainly put flax, ground flax, because of the heat element.
Right, yeah. Flax,
yeah.
The oil on the flax seeds is heat
sensitive.
Right,
it's too. Yeah, it's fragile.
If anyone recently won the lottery and wants to spend $60 a pound on chia seeds, I just want to give out the website address for Sherry. It's rawfoodchef.com.
Yeah.
And all right, next.
She sells it there.
That's right. Well, I'm sure you can order it online.
Yeah.
She's one of our contributors, too. And, in fact, for those asking about cheese or cheesy flavors, she was our guest expert on the call about vegan cheese and cream and contributed several recipes to that.
Yes, she's a great chef. Wonderful.
Oh, yeah. All right, next question is from Melanie. And one more about cheesy. She says, how can you get a cheesy flavor in soups without nutritional yeast?
I don't know. I guess I haven't sought for that flavor. It's not something that I can answer.
Right, okay.
Ask
well,
me anything about bean soups, and I'll tell you, because that's really been my forte and most interest, because I want the protein and fiber and nutrition and flavor.
Right. Well, let me throw out a thought. I'm imagining that the people asking the questions about cheesy flavors are relatively new to being vegan, and they still really miss cheese.
Mm-hmm.
I'll just kind of say this, what I've seen a lot of people go through as they transition from meat to vegetarian or vegetarian to vegan, is that at first when you switch diets, it feels limiting, and you're missing the foods that you're not eating anymore, whether it's cheese or ice cream or whatever. But after a while, you eventually just get accustomed to different flavors and different foods that become your favorites, and it's no longer such a big, you no longer really crave those other things. For example, I remember when I first became vegan, I bought, you know, used soy cheese as a staple. And yeah, I mean, there's so many, I mean, but for someone that's new and, you know, not, hasn't done a lot of research about nutrition, and still wants a cheesy flavor, they might buy that. So what I want to say is, like, now I'd rather have guacamole or hummus because they're still fatty. They have the fat mm-hmm. that I desire, but they're made from whole foods, and there's no fillers or preservatives or, you know, any of those gobbledygook type of ingredients that you get
yeah.
in processed foods.
It's the fat, and it's also the salt in cheese, though. That there's quite a bit of salt in regular cheese.
Right.
That people are missing. You know what I do sometimes, and I'm mostly vegan, but I will put a little bit of goat cheese, like drop a, like a half a teaspoon. I've got this half teaspoon measure in my head. Half a teaspoon of goat sprinkled on a soup or something, or on a salad.
On the top.
Yeah.
And which type of cheese is it?
Goat.
Oh,
so regular,
I mean, aren't
goat.
There... Aren't there different types of goat cheese?
Well,
no?
You know, Chèvre, you know, just like a soft goat cheese.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And so that's not
I'd rather
mixed in.
Have
that's
real
just...
cheese. I'd rather have a tiny bit of that to satisfy me than soy cheese or some of these other things that have so many chemicals and everything and aren't satisfying anyway.
Right. Yeah, I felt that way. Even when I was a hardcore vegan, I would rather take butter than margarine if I was in a restaurant, you know.
Well, that was wise. That's right.
Okay, so next question is from Raymond. Let's see. It's a little off topic. Let's wait and see if we – let's get through the other soup ones and see if we have time for it.
Okay.
So the next one is a comment. It just says, yes, there is sea salt in Herbamar.
Yeah, well,
and
it's
the first
one, ingredient. Yeah.
Well,
oh,
she's
sea
saying
salt.
It's
I
sea
see.
Salt, not just regular
sea salt.
Salt,
yeah, yeah.
Next question is, since you make lots of bean soups, do you use asafoetida, which is also in parentheses, H-I-N-G? Right.
You know, I have it, and I used it a couple times. It's supposed to help prevent gas, flatulence, but... I'm not sure that it does. I think some people have better digestive systems than others, and mine is not a great one. So I don't know anything that works for me. I just have to chew well and eat smaller amounts.
Okay. And there's actually 8 tips in the written lesson you wrote.
Yeah. Yeah, there are. Yeah.
For minimizing the gas that you would get from beans.
Yeah.
So
boiling it helps quite a bit. And then throwing off the water, boiling it again, throwing off the water of beans.
Right. And that's lesson 48.3. And, yeah, there's 8 different remedies for gastric distress. So
mm-hmm.
I want to refer people to that lesson. Next question.
And also kombu. Kombu is a, for people who don't know, it's a dried kelp, a dried sea vegetable that's very high in calcium and trace minerals and also helps to prevent gastric distress. So I always add that. I always add about 6 inches of kombu soaked and cut up when I make bean soup.
Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah, so there's 2 types of seaweed then. Didn't you mention a different type earlier? Kudzu.
No, well, kudzu is not, I was wondering why you're saying it's in the sea vegetable lesson. It's not a sea vegetable. Kudzu is kudzu is a it's a root. It's a tuber.
Oh, okay.
From a vine, and it's a white powder that it has a thickening quality like cornstarch or arrowroot. Only it's much more medicinal, and it's just much better for you, and it's very very effective. It only takes a teaspoon to solidify a whole cup of liquid.
Okay, and so
not
that,
solidify,
that
but I should say to thicken.
So kudzu is not used to help reduce the gas from beans.
No, that's just a thickener. That if the soup comes out too thin, you know, a remedy is to, as I describe it in the lesson, you just take like a teaspoon of kudzu and put it in cool water, dissolve it, and then pour it into the soup and cook it for 2 to 3 minutes. It goes from white, like a white liquid, to a translucent liquid, and then it just thickens it up.
That's great. And I'm sure it's healthier than cornstarch.
Oh, much, much, much. Yeah.
Okay. Actually, you know, since it sounds like we have some people new to the diet on this call, would you be able to tell them why cornstarch isn't the best choice for a thickener?
I don't know. I can't tell you why. It's processed. It's from corn. It's probably GMO corn, genetically modified. I don't know. I've never used it. I've always used arrowroot or kudzu, but I can just say I'd recommend using kudzu or arrowroot instead.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
All right. Let's see what our next question is. Okay, we are out of questions except for the one from Raymond. So if anyone else still has questions, we've got about 10 minutes left. Go ahead and post them now. But I'll ask Raymond's question, and let's see how that goes. He says, you indicated that the oxalic acid in spinach can bring on arthritis. I've been eating a green smoothie with raw spinach every day, and lately my right hand is feeling a little stiff. I eat a primarily vegetarian diet, and it's hard to believe that arthritis is setting in. Do you think the oxalic acid could be causing the stiffness?
Well, Dr. Norman Childers, I think his name is, I can't remember his last name, but he has been studying arthritis and the solanine or oxalic acid connection for many, many years, and his research indicates that 20% of the population is affected by oxalic acid and solanine, as solanine is in tomatoes and things like that, and potatoes, white potatoes. For me, I am in that 20%, and it does affect me. What I, you know, I'm not a doctor, of course, but what I would recommend when people say things like this is to say, don't eat any spinach for like a month. Use some other kind of green, kale or collards or whatever, and see what happens, and see if it goes away. I had been using a lot of wild plants like lamb's quarter and purslane and chickweed and nettles, and I was having about 30 leaves of lamb's quarter a day. I was putting them in smoothies and puddings and everything because they're so healthy for you. Except I didn't know they were so high in oxalic acid, and it caused an extreme attack of arthritis in my toes. So I stopped taking it. Then I took turmeric, which reduced the inflammation, and I'm okay. But it can. I mean, greens have alkaloids in them, and when you eat the same, that's why they always say to rotate if you can. To rotate greens and not have the same greens in the smoothies, green smoothies every day, because you'll end up with the same alkaloid, which can have reactions in the body like that.
So what are some of the greens that you like to use in your green smoothies?
Raymond
gets an idea of the variety that's possible.
Okay, kale, collards, tatsoi, bok choy, and we grow almost all our own food, so it's, you know, it's right out there. We just go out and pick it. And there's some I don't eat. My husband is the one who does most of the growing, so I don't even know the names of some of these greens. A lot of them are Japanese or Chinese. Joe, what are some of the greens? No, but some of the odd ones, like tatsoi. He's coming down. Arugula is a little too peppery, so we don't use that in the smoothies. Dandelion, yes, we grow a lot. That's right, we grow two different kinds of dandelion. We put nettles, we grow stinging nettles and put that in. Kale, we have three or four different kinds of kale. We have Siberian kale and curly kale, and you know what a wonderful one is that's very mild? Is the dinosaur or lacinato kale. That's very mild in flavor, and it's great in smoothies.
And it
so
takes
even
up less space
changing
in
the kind of kale will help. Huh?
I said the dino kale takes up less space in the fridge than regular curly kale.
Yeah, it does.
That's actually one of the things. All right, keep going.
No, I think that was it. I think he's done.
That's good. Yeah, so I use a much bigger variety than me, but I use kale. That's my number one in smoothies. Mm-hmm. I also have used dandelion greens because I can't imagine how else I would eat them since they're so bitter, but the banana, you know, kind of offsets that.
Yeah, and I put stevia. We grow stevia. I mentioned this before on calls, but we put the stevia in with these bitter things, and it really balances or neutralizes the bitterness. The other thing, I just wanted to make this one comment before I forget. A really wonderful thing to do, and I think it was mentioned in one of your other lessons here, is to take collards, which tend to be bitter unless they're boiled. I boil collards. We chop them up fine, like chiffonade or minced, you know, not minced, but diced small, and throw them in any soup, particularly a lentil soup or any bean soup, and it's a way of getting extra greens, which are really nutrient-dense. Lots of protein, lots of chlorophyll, lots of calcium. So I just want to encourage everyone to that's the last thing you can do. As the soup is cooking, you just boil up some greens or steam them, chop them up, and just put them in, and that can be a big garnish, like a quarter
cup. Oh, the garnish. Oh, okay. I was wondering why you don't just throw them into the soup broth and let them cook
soup. That's the thing. With collards, I feel that unless they're, I mean, we grow them and they're tender and they're sweet, but when you buy them, even organic, if you buy them at a grocery store and they're 2 weeks old, they seem to have gotten more bitter. So I wouldn't like to eat, I don't want it to affect the taste of my soup. So I will boil it in a pot of water, a little bit of water, and then pour out that water, and then take the cooked greens and put them in the soup.
I get all the
nutrients of that without the bitterness.
Got it. If you put the raw collards directly in the soup, then you get a bitter taste in the soup.
Yes, yes. It flavors the whole thing.
What other greens also have a bitter taste, and do you like to boil first before you put them in the soup?
Mustard greens. I think those are the only two. Collards just don't work well steamed. I have tried it a number of times to see if I'm imagining it, but I'm not.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that they're too bitter. There is one other. I think arugula sometimes I will, if I'm going to cook it, I will boil it first for a minute, just flash, you know, just do a quick flash in the pan for about a half a minute, take it out, and then saute it. If I'm going to saute it with some other greens.
Okay. We just have a couple minutes left. We have a good question here you referenced this in your written lesson. The question is, do you use any fruits with your soups? For example, oranges and a black bean stew, for example.
No. I think it's not good food combining. And if you have a strong constitution, you know, if you have a strong digestive system, then you can do anything. You can put anything together and it probably won't affect you. But most of us don't have such a great, strong digestive tract. And fruit and beans together are not a good combination. They're really gas-causing.
Right. And we talked about food combining in Lesson 8. So I want to refer everyone to check out the guidelines there. You know, you don't necessarily have to follow all of the guidelines exactly 100% of the time, but I guess it really has to do with how much indigestion you have when you combine different things together. If you have no indigestion and no bloating and no gas when you eat fruit and beans, don't have much incentive to follow the guidelines. But if you have indigestion and you're wondering why, the guidelines in that lesson should probably demystify what's happening in your body. All right, last question is from Patty, and she says, does arrowroot break down when the soup gets heated to a boil?
I'm sorry, would you ask that again? My husband was giving me a little note here.
Sure.
Does
arrowroot break down when the soup gets heated to a boil?
I have not used arrowroot in soup. I've used that for more like fruit. It's more like for thickening fruit pies and things. Kudzu is the one I really would use kudzu. I don't know if it would. I've always just used kudzu.
Okay, so arrowroot's better for a fruit type of dessert.
Yeah, like a fruit like if you're just heating up some fruit and putting some, and you want to thicken it, then I would put it in that.
Okay, great.
In that.
One last question came in, and it's how do you pick or dry your stevia?
How do I pick it?
I guess that means since you grow your own.
Okay, it's a bush, and you cut the after you have used it all summer long. I use it just fresh off the bush, and then as it starts to flower, I cut off the like a branch, and I'll tie a string on the bottom of the branch and hang it. We have a solar house, so the room there's a warm room where the solar stuff comes in and all. And we just hang it from a bar up there, and it just dries in about 3 days. I crumble it up, and then I put it in a jar, and I vacuum seal the jar. And then I put some in a smaller jar and use it all winter long, and then I buy another plant in the spring and start again.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I really appreciate your time tonight. Why don't you give everyone your website address and let them know what they can find there?
Okay, it's, you can either, well, it's www.lenoresnatural.com, Lenores, natural.com. And basically, my two cookbooks are on sale there, special internet price. And I always include a little handy cook's tool when you order it on the internet. DVDs are coming soon. I've written a bunch of articles that are posted there. There's recipes. There's an archive of a quarterly newsletter, and anybody can subscribe to this free quarterly seasonal newsletter where there's lots of information on health and cooking and the environment. Pardon?
Do people on your newsletter list receive recipes?
Sometimes we put recipes. Yeah, we actually are doing photos of how to do certain recipes. Yeah.
Okay, great.
Yeah,
well,
and
thank
it's free.
You very much.
We only do it like every 3 months or 4 months, so you're not going to be inundated with lots of emails.
Okay,
okay,
great. Well,
right.
I really appreciate your time, everyone. Thanks for joining us, and
yes.
Let me just say for the callers, we're going to do another Q&A the same time next Monday. The topic is fruit versus complex carbs. And then the very next night, which is a Tuesday, we'll be doing one on time-saving tips. Okay, and I'll email everyone about that. Have a good night.
Okay, Trevor, thanks. Good night, everybody. Cook soup. Bye.
Good night.